Orleans. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Everybody sings in the kitchen, but only a precious few sound like this.
Dava da femina felicita, dava da femina felicita, 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 felicita.
When she's not in the kitchen, Giovanna Joseph heads Opera Creole, a singing troupe that features music dating back to the nation's earliest operatic roots. Giovanna Joseph, after the break.
This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Most everything people do in a day is a continuation of what people have been doing for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. Cars have replaced horses, which replaced our own 2 feet. So we humans have always found a way to get where we want to go. Today, cineplexes are the coliseums of old. So for thousands of years, we've had some place to be on a Saturday afternoon. And for those who worship, people have been doing that whenever and wherever possible for as long as anyone can remember. Here in New Orleans, Giovanna Joseph is continuing yet another long-standing tradition, a tradition that began with this overture. We are hearing the overture of Sylvain, an operatic comedy in one act written by André Ernest Grétry. In 1797, Sylvain was the first opera ever performed in North America, and it happened right here in this city. In fact, New Orleans built the first opera house on the continent, and opera continues to be a part of life here. Giovanna Joseph is the founder of an ensemble of singers called Opera Creole. The group sings the works of all the usual suspects, Puccini, Verdi, Bizet, Gershwin. But Opera Creole also revisits contributions made by free people of color in 19th century New Orleans and other locally born artists. People like Edmond Dédé, Lucien Lambert, and Samuel Snyder. Giovanna Joseph joins us from her home. Thanks for having us over.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Oh, it is our pleasure. Believe me. To quote an old song, how long has this been going on? I mean, when did you first fall in love with opera?
Oh, my goodness. So many years ago. I started studying voice when I was 15 because I'd gone down to audition for North Theater. And
that was like 3 years ago, 15.
Yeah, 3 years ago. And the director said, sing out, Louise, basically. So I decided to start taking lessons, and when my teacher started introducing me to things, it solidified how I'd originally been impacted as a kid when my mom would have the TV on and Mario Lanza would come on singing, and I always noticed how she would just stop in her tracks, and she just was so mesmerized by it. And so my teacher helped to reinforce that feeling, and I decided that I was in love.
So this is Mario, be my love,
yeah.
Lanza, right?
Yes.
And so yes. Were you watching those Saturday afternoon movies that used to come on TV?
Yes.
I love those.
Yes.
They don't come on anymore.
I know.
That's a
shame. We had so many, and when I was a kid, there were so many different things on TV that you could see a little bit of different types of art and different types of music. And sometimes now it's just not there anymore. And it's really difficult.
Not there. You're right. And, you know, like even in one program, like the Ed Sullivan Show, you would see
Sullivan
the whole gamut,
yes,
from opera,
yes,
to, you know, to, I guess,
the
a couple
spinners.
Of guys from, you know, Slovakia, yeah, juggling.
Yeah, the plate spinners.
James
I like
Brown.
The plate spinners.
I love them. But so tell me, like, what Mario Lanza song comes to your mind when you think about those Saturdays with your mom?
No, it's the definitely Be My Love.
Really?
Yeah, that definitely comes to mind.
And I got that.
Your source of certainty.
Be my love for no one else.
fill my arms, the way you fill my dreams, the dreams that you inspire with every sweet desire.
Now, this is a guy who, Mario Lanza, who, in my mind at least, always sang and spoke in exclamation points. Don't get my lunch. You know, I mean, it could be anything, right? So was it the power of the voice that brought you, that intrigued your mother and yourself? Or was it something, was it just his masculinity? Or what was it that brought, you know, brought him to you in such a real way?
I think that I've learned over the years that my mom was really intrigued by the power of the voice, because she also had that feeling of Pavarotti. She just, you know, absolutely loved that sheer sound and power of the voice. So that definitely was it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now you grew up in Girt Town, is that correct?
Yeah.
And so tell us about your household, about your mom. What, how many people were in your family? What did it sound like in your house?
Well, I had two brothers, one older, one younger, and in my house was also my parents and my maternal grandmother. Shotgun house where there was no privacy. I never had the experience of getting to slam a door when I got I got upset about something.
The luxury of slamming doors.
Yeah. But there was always music, and my older brother and I, we loved to dance, so we would put on our little record box. You know, back then it was just a record box, and we would sing and we would dance and shake the house. We just, because my brother was definitely a James Brown fan. So when he started doing his James Brown dancing, we would shake the house, and just a fun place.
And so in your house, you're listening to classical, you're listening to operetta,
mm-hmm.
and you're listening to James Brown.
James Brown, Aretha Franklin, everybody. Yeah, yeah. So
wow.
It was a full exposure to different kinds of music, and gave you a chance to be okay with liking all of it, you know?
Absolutely.
That was the best part about it.
And so is James Brown the African-American equivalent of Mario Lanza?
I think so. One of my favorite videos is James Brown and Pavarotti together singing It's a Man's World. Awesome.
Man thinks about a little bit of baby girl and a baby boy. Men make them happy because men make them toys. But after men make everything you can, men make lira, pesos, dollars, rubles, and buy from every good woman.
There is nothing that is in rock and roll or R&B or headbanging metal music mm-hmm. or ska mm-hmm. that is not an opera in
right.
terms of the passion and the
right.
The, you know what I mean, the rebellion even
mm-hmm.
and the pain of the blues, you
yeah.
know what I mean, and all
yeah.
of that.
It's all there.
So you chose something that was very encompassing
yeah.
but very strange for a person coming up during James Brown's era.
Yeah, well, at least that's what I thought. But it turned out, you know, as I've learned my history, that it really wasn't that way.
And so can you think about a song maybe that you heard, that you had to listen to over and over again, and that helped you understand music as you understand it today?
Well, the song that I would say is part of my DNA because of my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, a wonderful bass baritone. And on Sundays, he would take us for rides, and he'd always sing. He'd sing the spirituals. And Deep River is the thing that even before opera, before everything, that's the thing that's attached to my DNA.
Deep River, my home is over Jordan. Deep River, Lord, I want to cross over into campground. Oh, don't you want to go to that gospel peace that promised land where all is peace? Deep River, Lord, I want to cross over into
I would get in a car with you on any day if you were going to sing that song. We could go down to Schwenkman's. We could go. We could go pay our energy bill. We could do anything as long as you were singing that. Now, what is it? I mean, it's a Negro spiritual, mm-hmm. right? I mean, this is a song that has been recorded by so many different people, yeah. white and black.
Yeah.
Because it captures something in you. What is it that it speaks to, do you think?
To me, it's like it's a longing and an understanding that you know that there's a place that has peace, that has all of that love that anyone would want in their life.
Is that something that's a common spiritual that people know?
It's a common spiritual that's done, I would say, in recital. I don't know that young people know it as well as they should. You know, that some of those songs are kind of getting lost in a sense. And in some ways, getting lost also because they think, well, you know, we're not slaves anymore. Why do we want to sing those things? But I always talk about when I perform for young people that the thing about slavery is that someone who had every excuse to be angry could write something like that.
Coming up, we'll talk about one of Javanna Joseph's great influences, the incomparable Lena Horne. It's Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Our guest is mezzo-soprano Javanna Joseph, the founder of Opera Creole.
I want to talk a little bit about some of your other heroes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we heard that that you have a particular attachment to Lena Horne.
Oh, Lena Horne. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather. Since my man and I ain't together, keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere. Stormy weather, just can't get my poor self together. Weary all the time, so weary all the time.
I can almost remember the moment I saw her on television, and there was this grace before she even opened her mouth. I saw this understanding of being distinctive, to be a person that is graceful, that is regal even. And I was looking at me that I wanted to be. I wanted to be just like that. She was me, I was her. But she also was pretty sassy, you know, and I loved the fact that she was so sassy. So.
You're right. I mean, she was able to add, I think, that, you know, that little trace of Macon, Georgia in her voice or whatever that mm-hmm. just made everything sound a little sexier than mm-hmm. it would have had, you know, Kate Smith been singing mm-hmm. it, you know?
Yeah.
So like Honeysuckle Rose yes. is so yes. beautiful.
Yeah.
Stormy Weather, which is yeah. just gorgeous. Yeah.
Even that sound is almost operatic, the way she handles it, really milking the melody and using the voice that way.
Mm-hmm.
Other than her voice and her, you know, incomparable appearance, you know, the thing that we remember most about Lena Horne was that after so many years in Hollywood, she was never able to break the color barrier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was never able to star in the films that she wanted to star in, that she was up for, the roles
right.
that she was actually up for,
right.
you know. And that seemed to leave her with a great deal of sadness.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel any sense of a parallel in opera, and when it comes to race? Obviously not the same, but are there similarities?
There was at one time, and I think that sometimes there still can be some difficulty, not so much in that not, you know, being up for something and just not being chosen because you're Black, but and sometimes being able to see persons in certain roles. You know, so a director may have an idea of what he wants it to look like, and you know, and so so there are still some difficulties in singers getting enough work, but I'm very proud to say the New Orleans Opera does a wonderful job of hiring people of color in those roles that you would not necessarily think has to be a person of color, and There are many times when we have two and three African Americans in lead roles in like Tosca and Rigoletto, and the community doesn't know how great of a job that they actually do with that, but they really are fantastic.
You know, I remember years ago a music teacher once told me that Black or African American singers, opera singers, can often be identified by a certain color in their voices.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard that?
Yeah, I've heard that. But one of the great opera singers, Shirley Verrett, who was born in New Orleans, she said no one could ever identify that in her voice. She wasn't sure whether it was always true. There's a certain extra amount of color that you can hear, and sometimes not necessarily. So you don't always know that it's a person of color by the voice.
Right. Yeah. Now, you are a mezzo-soprano. What can you do? What can't you do?
The mezzo-soprano is kind of odd in the opera stories. She tends to be the bad girl.
Ooh.
Or she tends to be an old lady or a witch or a sorceress, you know. And so it gets interesting, the interesting roles that you can do. Not always do we have the very lead. Just like the bass baritones tend to be the villains and the, you know, the older men and that sort of thing. So operas use the voice type to further describe the character.
But it seems like it would also give you more longevity in opera, in singing opera. Like, I'm thinking about Kathleen Battle, who was not a mezzo-soprano,
no,
right?
No.
And she seemed to be stuck in playing these ingenue kinds of roles mm-hmm. that ultimately, once you reach a certain age, don't seem appropriate for you.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that for her, artistically, it must have been, you know, confining.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So would you say that a mezzo-soprano has more legs in a way in terms of her career?
Well, it's a lot of the times Kathleen Battle's voice, not only was she a soprano, but there was a certain lightness of the voice that would be used to describe more of an ingenue character. Had she been a dramatic soprano, she would have moved into some of those other big roles. But in a lot of cases, when you kind of fall into that niche, sometimes you do get more work because there's not everybody that, there's not Kathleen Battles walking around all over the place. So it worked for her to do roles that a regular soprano might not necessarily do.
Now, you are nowhere near the age of a person who would have seen Marian Anderson perform live. I don't think I'm walking out too far on a limb to say
like
that.
It sometimes, but, yeah.
But the thing is, you know, Marian Anderson has oftentimes become more known for that one moment in her career when mm-hmm. she sang at the Lincoln Memorial
right,
in Washington.
Right.
She's sort of been associated more with civil rights mm-hmm. in a way than she's ever been as a great singer.
Yeah.
Was she?
Oh, she was definitely a great singer.
What defines a great singer?
Oh, my goodness. I remember when I first got to Loyola, my teacher said, go to the library. There are recordings of Marian Anderson. I got to hear her sing Schubert Lieder, the German Lieder. It's just such a wonderful sound. And unfortunately, recording wasn't as sophisticated as it is today, so we don't really get to fully hear what her voice is. She was called a contralto, which is lower than a mezzo. It's, you know, she has that very bottom of her range, but she also had an extremely high range as well. So she had a full, extensive range that she could sing soprano things as well. But her ability to really communicate the music, to master the music, she was excellent no matter what language.
You know, the fact that recording has changed so dramatically over the years,
mm-hmm.
has sort of made a victim not only of Anderson, but of generations of opera singers. You know, if you want to hear the great Caruso, for instance, you know, he doesn't sound like anything next to Placido Domingo. Mm-hmm. And I'm, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm sure he could outsing Placido Domingo. You see what I mean?
Yes.
How can you detect greatness in a recording that is so compressed or difficult to appreciate in its minutia?
For me, I try to listen past the white noise, you know, to listen past the white noise. I did have some recordings of Caruso, and you kind of know when if you know, if you've learned or you've heard those certain arias enough, you know what to expect. And there's still, even with Caruso, even though a recording wasn't that great, there's still a power that comes through.
You know, I had a landlord once who, the first time we ever met here in New Orleans, he told me, I believe that I'm the love child of the great Caruso. And he said that his mother was a reporter for the New Orleans Bee or one of the older New Orleans papers, now defunct, and that she interviewed Caruso when he came to town and spent a notable amount of time in his hotel room. So it just, you know, I mean, that's, I love that story because it he was so proud of that. I mean, that was the one thing that he made a point of saying in our first meeting. You see what I mean? And so it made me think of how people, you know, how opera singers are not unlike, you know, any other superstars
in
the sense that if I were the love child of, oh, I don't know, Otis Redding or something, that's the first thing I'd tell you too. But so let me ask you this. Now, as you say, Marian Anderson, you know, spent an awful lot of time in Europe. You know, I mean, how much of Black culture, African American culture, has been tended or flowered abroad as opposed to in the United States?
It's true that a lot of singers have gone that way. And when I was first coming out of Loyola, a lot of people were saying you should just leave here and go, you know, go to France or go to Germany and that sort of thing. And there are a lot of people that are indeed getting a lot of work over there. But it has gotten better over the years. It's gotten better, especially having companies like New Orleans Opera doing a better job of seeking them out and making those opportunities available. But I think still, though, that a lot of singers are still going to Europe.
Why didn't you go to Europe?
I don't know. I didn't originally want to go, and then I got married, and when my daughter came into the world, I said, this is my the best blessing ever in the world. So I wanted to stay with her, and so worked out, and now she's an opera singer as well. She sings with Opera Creole.
Exactly, and you named that child Aria.
Yes.
Now, what would have happened if she'd been born tone deaf? Now, wouldn't you feel bad?
Well, you know, I always would tell her she has to be whoever she was born to be. But at the time I was expecting, I was cantor at St. Raphael in Gentilly. And people kept saying, you know, I always thought that after a while you lose room and you can't breathe, but you seem to be singing better while you're expecting. And so when I saw the word in actually a baby name book, I decided that she was God's song to me. And so I gave her that name.
Oh,
opera Creole?
Because, I mean, this is a relatively young ensemble, isn't it? This whole endeavor seems relatively young, even though you're dabbling in, some of the oldest music known to Western civilization.
Yes. We are pretty much a new group. We have great singers. Tyrone Chambers is our tenor. My daughter's the other mezzo-soprano, and Brandon Richardson is our baritone. And so we are moving and grooving.
Since we spoke with Giovanna Joseph, Opera Creole has grown from an ensemble into a company, which includes nearly all of the artists she mentioned, as well as baritone Terrence Brown and soprano Kenya Lawrence Jackson. Pianist Wilfred Delphin retired. Opera Creole's new pianist is Ashlyn Sims. For more information about members of the company, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org. Coming up, we explore the classy underbelly of scat. Stay tuned. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and we're visiting with mezzo-soprano Giovanna Joseph, the founder of Opera Creole. Let's talk about some of the composers that you all feature in your recitals and in your public appearances. Now, these are composers who were free people of color or the children of free people of color, who were either born in New Orleans or who somehow have a tether here. Mm-hmm. But I bet you could walk down this, Magazine Street, and you wouldn't find one person who could name, or maybe you would find, it's a 9-mile street, so maybe you would find a few people, but you wouldn't find many people who would know those names, like Dede, Le Chevalier, de Saint-Georges. Mm-hmm. I mean, who were these people?
Well, and to me, they were miracle people. They were amazing people. And they should be celebrated for their music, for their accomplishment, but also as a reminder for young people that no matter your circumstances, you can be excellent and you can excel. And here we are in the 1800s in New Orleans, where slavery was happening, and also we had the largest population of free people of color in all of North America. And they were very enamored with education, with the arts, and with making sure that their children got those opportunities to learn whatever their heart's desire was. If it became furniture making or learning to play the violin and composing, that those families were very on point with making sure that those things happened, and even sent them to France to learn from some of the best composers of the day. And so that's really a fantastic piece of history to know.
And were these the children of Plassage? I mean, in I guess Louisiana lore, you had unions between Creole women, for instance, and wealthy white men, mm-hmm. and children came from that union. Oftentimes, they were educated in Europe, those children, or sent to Europe in some kind of way. Were any of these composers, from that familial background? Or
some of them may have been. I'm not sure that it was they're immediate as far as their immediate parents. But in terms of Edmond Dede, his parents came to New Orleans as free people, and they were not of mixed race. They came, and at that particular time in New Orleans history, if you came to New Orleans or to Louisiana as a free person, you remained a free person. But I don't know exactly in terms of Lambert and the others, but they did have some of that lineage in terms of whether it was a plissage or whether it was just joined by love. But they would have been a French and, you know, of an African and Native American ancestry, this sort of thing.
For reasons that are completely superficial, I would like to talk about Le Chevalier de Saint-Georges. I think, from the one image that I have seen of him, that he looks like Mary J. Blige on a bad day. A bad hair day, I should say, okay? What was that man thinking, and what do you know about him? And do you actually perform a piece of his music?
Yeah, Valerie Francis sings one of his scenes from the opera Ernestine. That's one of the things that we do, and we're expanding a little bit more on his music. But I've seen several pictures, and I think he's just gorgeous. So,
well, yeah, Mary J. Blige is good looking. Yeah.
We got to get it wrong. Mary J is in the spot tonight, and I'ma make you feel alright.
Well, it always takes people back, especially when he had the powder wig on and that sort of thing. So young guys, whenever I go to schools, they're like, that's a man.
Now, I don't think there's any African-American opera singer who has ever been able to sidestep Porgy and Bess in his or her career.
Well, there are many who have tried, and there are many who have, there are still some that just won't do it.
Now, that all came to the fore recently when on Broadway, a production mounted that initially sought to change some of the storyline, or the setting at least, to make it seem a little bit less about poor trifling black folk. To cut to the chase, okay? So, I mean, do you have a view of that kind of thing? Does the storyline, the story of a woman who is essentially, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but is a prostitute who falls in love with a man who is infirm, against the desires of her pimp, for lack of a better word, and they're all living on, in like what would be considered the bottoms of any, segregated town.
Well, there's definitely issues about the characters. I can understand when people are saying they don't feel that they're given portraying African Americans in the best, most positive light. But once I did the first production, I start to see it from a different perspective. And I see it more as a show about how people in these dynamics and situations try to survive, and how they persevere, and how they still want and they hope for change, for a better life. And the people of Catfish Row are very spiritual people. And so much of the music is just sacred, and goes back to the feeling of in slavery in this time when you're dealing with a lot of different issues, that you still look up to heaven, you still raise your voice to heaven. And so I see it in more in a complex way like that. I really would like to see someone do another opera based on what happens when Porgy goes and gets Bess, and that's how it ends, with him going to find her.
Oh, Lord, I'm on my way.
so much of Opera Creole is a celebration of what has been. You know, what has been in the past, you know what I mean? But you are living in today. You are living in the 21st century, as your ensemble is, and you are competing against bounce music and Beyonce and, you know what I mean, trombone shorty and, you know what I mean, brass bands. You know what I mean? You're competing for the attention of people who live in this community.
Right.
And so how do you make what you all do not sound like the musical equivalent of spinach, you know, something that's good for you, but maybe that you don't want to eat all the time.
Right. Well, one of the ways that I try to do it is to make those connections to the things that they do know. And also to talk more about the fact that opera and jazz are so very closely related.
And I didn't know that. But you mean through like Jelly Roll Morton or?
Jelly Roll Morton and a lot of those early jazz pioneers were aficionados in one way or another and were influenced. And Louis Armstrong was a big, big opera fan. And so one of the things that I do in the concert is I sing something that would be from an opera that would be called coloratura singing, where you sing with lots of notes. It's very flowery. And then I do a little scat afterwards so they can see that there may be a relationship there.
Oh, do that. Can you do it? Can you do a little bit for us?
Let's see.
Da vaga femina felicita, da vaga femina felicita, 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 felicita.
So it kind of comes together.
That's marvelous. I wonder if that's what Louis Armstrong, I mean, you know what I mean? How Louis Armstrong got to the point of scatting.
I think there may be some connection. I don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But Caruso, he loved Caruso. He loved Amelita Gallicherchi, who was a coloratura singer. And don't know. Could have been.
That's a phenomenal. You have taught us something today. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so let me ask you this. Now, another journalist I know, when she went for a job interview once at a magazine, and the editor asked her, do you want power or do you want glory? And what the editor meant was, do you want to be an editor, which is a powerful position, or do you want the glory of having your name on in the magazine, you know, on your byline in the magazine? And the truth is, I mean, in your position, I can ask you the same question, because you are the founder of Opera Creole. You're, you know, its chief cheerleader and, you know, administrator. But at the same time, you are a performer. Do you dream of performing, or do you dream of putting together an institution that will outlive you?
I dream of both, and I can't seem to separate them, because I always think of the child that was me, that's out there now, that should know their history. And even as a performer, that drives me first. And to bring this out into the community, to let people know about the contributions of people to this music, is in part, I don't think I would want to be a performer without it.
That's beautiful. We've talked about sacred music a couple of times in the course of our interview. Now, let me ask you this. Do you have to be a believer in order to effectively communicate sacred music?
Some people are very good at singing and performing. I feel like I can tell the difference if they're a believer or not, but I there's nothing scientific behind that. I think to really communicate with people and to touch people, you have to believe. That's just my feeling about it. And I've been singing in the church my whole life, you know, from a very little kid. And it's, in terms of sacred music, it is really, I call it my glue. It's my glue. And it's no matter what I'm going through. And my father even predicted it when I was in college. I was going through a little something. He says, no matter what happens in your life, you always have your music. And right after Katrina, when I realized that my, I don't know if I should tell the story.
Please.
Right after Katrina, when I realized that my house was soaking in 11 feet of water, I was visiting a friend down in Galveston, and we went to church, and they said, oh, why don't you sing something for us? And I realized nothing would come out. No sound would come out of my mouth. First time ever in my life, and I realized I was in shock. And so I could not sing. But in the back of my mind, I need thee every hour kept running. And I couldn't get it out, but I started paying attention that it was running. And so it was like my soul was asking God for help, even though I couldn't do it. And so if you don't have that, then you're likely to more be a more glory person, but the glory won't satisfy you in the end. So I think you have to believe.
Do you remember the lyrics to I Need? No.
I need thee every hour, most gracious Lord. No tender voice like thine can peace afford. I need thee, oh, I need thee every hour. I need thee, oh, bless me now, my Savior. I come to
is stunning. Thank you. Isn't it wonderful to be able to move yourself to tears when you say I am not moved to tears when I say
exactly.
I used to get mad at myself. I used to, you stupid thing, and making yourself cry.
Our guest is mezzo-soprano Giovanna Joseph, the founder of Opera Creole.
Thank you so very much for letting us into your...
Thank you. I appreciate
into
it.
...into your house and
I
into your
it.
Heart, you know?
This is so wonderful.
And you've been listening to a rebroadcast of Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Thomas Walsh, Jason Rhine, Bridget McCarthy, Margaret Howes, and Sean Collins. This week's theme song is Classified by James Booker. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. For more information about Opera Creole, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, the Pinkalope Foundation, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, Adam Newman Designs, Shop Nadine Blake, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax deductible, thanks to our partnership with National Performance Network. For more information about how you can support our program, please go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.